Good noon, America. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine. I am on the line with me,
Terry D. Kester.
And I suspect that Garland Nixon will be arriving shortly, tardily, the way he sometimes does. So we have quite a show for you tonight, today, whenever you listen. I mean, you know, today, tonight,
yeah.
Middle of the night, middle of the day, you know, while you're listening to the podcast, perhaps, Mark Levine.
And at least I hope they're listening two or three times to each show.
I would think so. And taking notes. And taking notes and marking every time, you know, Mark is right versus when, say, Terry's right or Garland's right.
So. Oh, man. That's going to confuse them completely because you were right, what, was it last week or was it a year ago?
I believe it's every show.
Oh, really?
I'm not sure
what
you're talking about. We do have quite a big show for you tonight. Three very, very important topics. One is the State of the Union in general and what President Obama is going to talk about. The second is in my home state of Virginia. I am extremely proud of my Attorney General.
Amen.
For taking really a brave step. It is the Constitution, so it shouldn't be that brave, but it is brave to enforce the federal Constitution, which means not enforcing marriage discrimination laws. And then Garland, I know, wants to talk about worldwide income inequality, which, of course, is vitally important. I was just reading the other day, 85 people in the entire world have more money than 3.5 billion.
And you know, the sad fact of that, Mark, is I don't know any of those 85 people.
You know? You don't go to their parties, Terry?
No, I haven't been invited to their parties.
Oh, my God, the Koch brother parties, the Walton family. No.
They just haven't, no.
You know,
in the past, I've worked with some of them, but I don't think at their party, even. I think probably the richest person I've ever worked with was Ted Turner, but...
He's a piker compared to
he's
85.
He's
I mean, you know.
He does have over 2 million acres in the United States, though.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. And 3.5 billion people combined have less wealth than that. So we're going to get to all of those topics. Again, we await Garland's entry.
Well, I'm not sure we're awaiting, but, you know, when he comes in, you know, we're grateful and we're glad he's with us, and, you know, we hope he shapes up.
Absolutely. Why don't we start with the State of the Union?
Sure.
Is the State of the Union strong, as the president says every year for the last 50 years? What do you think, Terry?
It's 99%. I wish we'd get rid of it, frankly. You know, it's 99% showbiz, which is boring as all get out, only satisfying the people there that are celebrating themselves, you know, which is the way the rich and the powerful always do.
It's in the Constitution, Terry. We can't quite get rid of it. You don't have to give a speech. But, it could be done written. It actually used to be done in writing prior to Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, it was done in writing for the most part. There were a couple of, you know, times when it wasn't. But, I mean, it works in writing. It could be, of course, it'd be awfully long. But, you know, it's for the most of us, it's just worthless because it is showbiz. It is, you know, a buffet of every single issue you can think of, you know, and the president, no matter who it is, I'm not blaming Obama, you know, promises that everything is wonderful and everything's going to be fixed, and what isn't fixed enough will be fixed more by tomorrow or Thursday. And it's meaningless. If President Obama would please make it a short State of the Union and, you know, briefly assess a couple of the issues. Yeah, we're in a mess in Afghanistan. We're trying to get out. It's a mess. Yeah, we're making some progress.
Hello, Garland here.
But you know, not enough.
Well, Garland, you have joined our discussion at mid-progress.
And so, there's really nothing Garland needs to say at this point. But anyway.
Are you driving, Garland? Because I hear all manner of wind rustling in the background.
Yeah.
Ah, that's better.
Well,
whatever you did.
Will you, for heaven's sakes, next you'll be texting while you drive. Grief. Anyway.
So Terry wants to get rid of the verbal State of the Union speech. He wants to go back to the way it was done in writing.
No,
prior,
I want to go back
years
to
ago.
Something meaningful.
Meaningful in politics? Terry, have you been smoking that dope again? God, we tried to get
you
off that stuff.
Denver, Washington State,
yeah,
or something.
Right. Now, if President
He's
Obama...
hugging a tree in Oregon, smoking his weed.
That's Washington, not Oregon.
You got trees there.
Yeah, if he would just concentrate on something pragmatic about the income inequality, the wealth inequality.
Well, I think he will.
Not just in the world, but in the United States. And forget giving us, you know, this grocery list of every single issue that he's going to solve in the next 2.5 years, because he's not going to be able to make progress in practically anything for the next 2.5 years. And that's a reality. And he should talk about the partisanship that's dividing the country. And he should talk about income inequality and just stress that one issue, because, as you know, even on a radio show or when you're lecturing in a classroom, people usually walk away with one idea.
Well, I'll tell you this. I think he will talk about income inequality, and I'm glad he will.
Yeah.
I do think he'll give us the laundry list, because that's what they do. It's like, you know, boring as all get out. It's what the prime minister did in England hundreds of years before we became a country. I mean, it's what you do. You set out your agenda for the year. I don't think
the king sent out agendas
for
the year.
Not the king.
Just said,
the prime minister.
You're not.
Yeah, the prime minister. The prime minister.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that I don't think that nothing will be accomplished. I actually think immigration reform is the one issue that I think has a decent, I'd even be willing to give a 60% shot of passage, which is the highest I've given for almost anything in this Congress. I think that can be achieved. I'm not sure what else can be achieved, given the partisanship. But Garland, do you have any hope for the future?
Yeah, I've got hope for things. None of them involving politics in Washington, D.C.,
okay.
But there are lots of other things I have hope for.
And the sun will shine, the birds will sing.
Yeah. But, I feel one of the statements Terry made is right, you know, that he doesn't have any faith that anything's going to happen. That one of the issues we have here now is it's 2014 and you have a party where the leadership is scared to death of the base, and they very well ought to be.
In the Republican Party, you think that's
true? Yeah, the Republican.
Okay, I don't know if that's true in our party.
What's going to happen throughout this year is they're going to be so concerned that if in any way, shape, or form they even appear to be cooperating with President Obama, I don't care if it's something that every Republican agrees with. The fact that the president's doing it or the Democrats are doing it means they have to go against it. So you're going to see, in my opinion, they're going to double down in an election year on their obstinance. I do think the president should focus on inequality. I think he has to talk about the Affordable Care Act and give some numbers and give some updates. I think he really has to touch on that and give some highlights, hopefully maybe some success stories about somebody whose life was saved because, you know, they found out they had cancer or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, of course, when he does that, fully expect half the Congress to stand up and cheer while the other half sit there glumly and maybe even boo.
You know what he should really feature, which would really be important and really be bold, and I'd love for Obama to be bold, would be, and I think it was in Time Magazine or the New York Times, but this whole series of articles or article about how the Republicans have gained control, the very rich Republicans have, from all over the country, have gained control of state legislatures throughout the country.
Absolutely, through ALEC.
Particularly, you know, I think it was it Alabama or Arizona where they only have Alabama, I think they only have 10 Democrats left in the whole legislature. The Republican money machine has literally, the Republican conspiracy, the conservative conspiracy that is there, the right-wing conspiracy that Hillary warned us about, has taken over something like 25 or 30 states in terms of getting strictly a Republican governor and a Republican Congress, and gerrymandered the whole thing and structured the whole thing that the Democrats are never going to get in. That should be a national issue.
Well, I don't think he's going to go there at the State of the Union and complain that too many state legislatures are under Republican control.
It's corruption. What do you think sustains the income inequality besides corruption?
Well, rich people paying lots of money to make sure they stay rich. That's what they do.
Yeah, we call that corruption.
I don't know. They did it right here in Virginia, and the governor could take all kinds of gifts, Rolex watches and loans and his daughter's weddings. And and he's been indicted for it. But, I'm sure that the watch was very nice.
Let's face it. We the people do not own our government. We simply don't own it.
Go ahead, Gong.
Yeah, I think he has to talk about climate change. I mean, you know, with the polar vortexes floating all over the place, with, you know, the West Coast dry as a hay barn.
Can you send me some water about that?
But the sad thing about this whole thing is that it's all ceremonial. That we have a small group of, you know, 60 or so people in the Tea Party members who believe that their job is to stop everything from happening, and that we have, you know, probably 20% of the country or less that are maybe 18% that are Tea Party people who want to be a ruling minority. And, you know, because the way our government is set up, it's hard to do something, but it's not that hard to gum up the whole process and stop anything from happening. They found that flaw in our government, and they're exploiting it.
And it's not just that flaw in the government. It's the flaw, too, again, and it gets back to the income inequality, is every single law, I don't care if it's immigration or whatever it is 99% written by the moneyed interest. It always has been for the last umpteen years. It is constant now, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, no matter what it is, it's always got private industry, private wealth as the primary interest in it. Whatever the other facade is, even like with affordable care, what that really is doing is providing tons of money to the insurance companies, which is exactly what the insurance companies wanted.
Well, money is the mother's milk of politics, don't you know? If you can't buy a politician and bring them home, I mean, that's the American way.
Well, if we really have gotten to that point, and it really is that true,
I think we should have drive-throughs. You know, like you do at McDonald's. Yeah, I'll take two politicians to go. Here's my billion dollars. But
if it's really that bad, then we have to accept the fact that we don't own the government, and we have to get back into the streets. I know I've said that occasionally before.
But you know what we can also do? We can also do what Gorbachev did. You go enter the system, then change it from within. I mean, use money. Get a politician who actually wants to end money in politics, and yet you might have to pay him to get him there. You might have to support
to
his campaign.
But it is ironic.
It is ironic, but sometimes, I mean, Gorbachev worked his way within the communist system and then got to the top and tore it down. And I think you have to spend money, because let's face it, there are rich liberals out there that, notwithstanding their own wealth, understand that we shouldn't have politicians that are bought and sold and would be willing to support a candidate who doesn't do that.
Yeah, but how would he get it past Congress? I mean, you can't do anything, you know, that way. You really can't. The only thing the president can do these days is executive directives, and then that'll be repealed or changed by the next president. I mean, it's sort of a meaningless.
Got to change Congress. Got to change state legislators. Got to work harder in elections.
There's something else to think about, and that is, Mark, the reality of even your example of Russia. And that is, yes, he was able to tear down a corrupt government and, a corrupt system. And now they have a very corrupt government and corrupt system.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although there were about 8 years under Yeltsin where the leader was only a little corrupt and very drunk, but he wasn't particularly authoritarian. So for Russia, those 8 years under Yeltsin was actually some of the best years in Russian history.
Yeah, but what we looked
by
at
their standards,
is,
that was good
you
news.
Know, was I would say, you know, what ultimately happened in Russia, you know, the question is, wasn't that inevitable? You know,
I like to think not.
Clean? Can you keep something clean now with the moneyed interest, with the corporations? And we say, oh, the corporations, you know, they run our government. No, they run all government. They don't just run our government anymore. They are multinational, and we are just the tip of it. They focus a little bit more on ours because ours is the biggest one.
Yeah, I mean, what's happened in Russia and what happened in China is, you know, incredible personal wealth by private individuals, private industry, in cahoots with the Communist Party. And we have the same thing in the United States. It's just we don't, you know, use the word communist, but we have every single act of legislation and government is involved with corporate and personal financial wealth.
And with that, that's optimistic, news. Happy news on a cold day when there's not much sun shining, let's take a break and come back with happier news because I want to talk about Attorney General Mark Herring. And really, I'm very, very proud of him. I didn't expect it, I have to say. I didn't expect it. I mean, I knew he's a good guy. I worked very hard to elect him. And then when a politician that you elect actually does what they say they're going to do, It's a rare and wonderful thing. We'll be right back with more of the Raucous Caucus right after these messages. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with
Terry DeCastro.
Carla Nixon.
There we go. They actually waited each other's turn. I always try to make them.
Yeah, we're
the same
we're
time.
Basically polite giving people.
Yes. That makes you rare in Washington, D.C. Of course, you're in Oregon and you're in Maryland.
It makes it rare in Oregon, too, trust me.
Really?
Yeah, right.
I think of Oregon as a bunch of polite tree huggers. You go around and you hug trees and you say howdy to the beaver and then smoke some weed. And that's not how Oregon works?
No. I mean, Oregon, the countryside is magnificent.
I'm sure.
The city of Portland is an industrial dump.
Oh, it is?
You know, and there's a lot of artistic activity here, which is wonderful, and I'm part of it, and I enjoy it, and I appreciate it. But politically, it's no different than Texas.
Industrial dump? Yikes.
It's amazing how industrial it is. It's amazing how industrial
I think
it is.
I think of the Northwest. I think of the tall trees, and I think of the ocean, and I think of bright clean air.
And Bigfoot. They have Bigfoot out there in the Northwest. That's where the Bigfoot sightings are always.
Sasquatch,
like
right?
Old growth forest or something in Oregon.
You haven't been in a big port in a while, have you?
Guess not.
But it's still nice.
I'm glad you're happy in your industrial waste.
I am enjoying it.
keep an eye out for Bigfoot.
Well, actually, Oregon.
I intend to change everything politically that's happening here.
Well, I appreciate that because it's up to you to make Oregon the next state to have marriage equality, and it looks like it might be. But I am very, very proud of my home state, which it may be beating you to it because Virginia, let's face it, is not exactly known for progressive values. They may say Virginia is for lovers, but the Loving family was not too happy with Virginia when Richard and Mildred Loving got married in the 1960s, an interracial couple. They were basically told to leave or they would be imprisoned.
Because
who you interracial
love in
marriage
Virginia is very important.
Was illegal. Virginia was the state, the Commonwealth, that was defending sexism, basically, defending keeping women out of the Virginia Military Institute. Virginia has a long history, just like most of the South, of segregation and oppression.
And racism.
But you know what? That's the old Dominion. Let's talk about the new Dominion. Because my state is proudly changing from red to purple to indigo. I'm not going to say where it blew yet. But I would argue that we have moved from purple to indigo because we elected in the last election.
By 500 votes?
I'll take it!
Not a shift in color.
I'll take it. We elected a Democratic.
Kind of a mauve. I'm going to go with mauve.
A Democratic governor, a Democratic lieutenant governor, a Democratic attorney general. Yes, by 907 votes, but who's counting? And it looks like, and there's another recount tomorrow on a very close race in the Senate to replace our lieutenant governor, Ralph Northam, down in the Norfolk area. And the that part of Virginia that's across the bay in the Delmarva Peninsula. We won there by 9 votes. But assuming we hold up there, then the Democrats will control the Virginia Senate as well. And the only place we won't control is the Virginia General Assembly, the House of Delegates, where we're behind like 2-1 because of gerrymandering. Yeah. Or Congress, for that matter, where they've gerrymandered a state with 11 congressmen, members of Congress down to 8-3, even though
other than that, it's moving towards mauve.
We're getting there. We're moving from purple to indigo. And Mark Herring, who did squeak in as Attorney General, did something really amazing, considering that Mark Herring himself, back in 06, voted against marriage equality. But it's been 7 years, and it's amazing. I can't think of a single issue in American politics that has moved this quickly, this fast. And that includes everything. That includes even civil rights. It wasn't 7 years.
No, hardly.
You know, the idea that gay people should be discriminated against, to the idea that gay people should be treated like everyone else, is the majority opinion in Virginia. Of course it's the majority in Massachusetts. We expected that. In Maryland, yes. But
you mean majority by polling?
By polling.
By voting.
By polling. Yep. By polling. Okay. And so my point is that not only is the Attorney General following the Constitution, federal Constitution of the United States, he's also doing something that's popular. What do you know?
Well, not about popular. I don't know if you saw his interview. I think it was or heard his interview on either PBS or NPR. I'm not sure. It was truly one of the most impressive interviews I've ever heard a politician give because, one, he didn't dodge any of the questions. Two, he was very straightforward. You know, he was very direct. and very clear about what he was doing. I thought it was one of the most impressive speeches I've ever heard, not speeches, interviews I've ever heard from a politician. And my hat's off to that guy. And just to remind you, even though I'm way out here, most of my life I lived in Virginia, so it's very important to me. And I'm really glad to see this gentleman in there.
And it's we folks in Northern Virginia that are changing it, obviously, for the rest of the state, because there are still some areas of Virginia that are let's say, not as supportive. But Virginia's changing. And with it, you know, maybe we can change the rest of the country. So, Garland, can we finally be optimistic about something? Please.
Yeah, certainly. And, it's that struggle that we've got going on in America. And I think Virginia, you know, kind of being one of the southern states that's closest to the north, you know, to the north, that transition is representative of that struggle that's going on. You know, the only thing you worry about is, you know, the Democrats won, and yeah, it was close, and, you know, the Tea Party really, you know, threw a monkey wrench into the Republicans' plans. But, you know, can we hold on to it? What's going to happen? I think Democrats and the Democratic Party in Virginia need to really, you know, work for some long-term strategies. So that this thing can't flip back, because as much as you can get out of it, if these people can get the legislature back, they'll turn it all back. So I think you need long-term strategies here, and I really like what I'm seeing. But it doesn't surprise me, because when the Democrats get, you're not going to get everything you want, certainly, but you're going to get some things you want, and you're going to get some reason, as opposed to, you know, everything acting by everything, you know, is an article of faith.
I do think, though, Virginia reminds us, again, of the power of gerrymandering, because even though the Democrats won all three statewides, they voted for Obama in Virginia. Then we have two Virginia senators. Every statewide race in the last couple years has gone entirely for the Democrats. The Republicans still control the General Assembly almost by 2-1. They in Virginia, they have 8 of the 11 congressional seats, and that's all because of the drawing of district lines. So what you got to do is you got to win victories even with a handicap. You got to hold them and then, you know, redraw the lines. Unless there's any hope, dare I say, for Congress to do something about gerrymandering nationwide.
Oh, yeah, right.
I just thought we'd give a little levity for the morning.
There's a dosage problem for you.
Okay, I'm not going to bet you on that one, but
no.
I will.
And you're expecting campaign finance reform is probably be written into the same bill.
Right. And in that same bill, corporations are not people, and children are. Actually, children will have rights, and corporations will not have the rights of individual human beings. We can dream, can't we?
They'll call it the Unicorn Protection Act.
There you go. I like unicorns. They're furry good, and they just you know, stay out of the way of the horn. And
The
they
Democratic
fly,
Party
don't
they? Does
it's theoretical.
The Democratic Party does need to realize, I mean, there's some very smart people, unfortunately, in the Republican Party. And the Republicans, besides their harassment of the federal government, you know, they really, really have, as this article I'm alluding to, you know, pointed out, they really have shifted their focus to state legislatures because they can get more done there. They have more muscle in the state situations, in the local situations, and they are just winning like crazy in that area. I mean, and it's they're taking over state after state. The legislation is getting more and more restrictive in every single way. Funds are being cut from social programs, from schools, et cetera, et cetera. The Republicans are actually winning in the country overall,
well, let's
state
face it.
By state, and the Democrats have got to realize that and come back swinging.
It's easier to buy a state legislator than even to buy a member of Congress because, first of all—
Not easier, just less money.
Well, it's cheaper, but it's also easier because they're not as well-known. Some people can name their congressman, many can name their senator, very few can name their state assemblyman or state delegate or whatever you have in your state. And what that means is these people go under the radar, and you have people like or groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Council, something like that. But basically what that is Koch brothers and other extremely rich people funding ways to buy politicians. And, you know, we used to have limits on that. There used to be limits on the amount you could give to a political candidate. And those limits still technically exist. But in this land of super PACs and Citizens United, it's just, the most fascinating thing I found about the Koch brothers, and I was not a big fan before I read this, but the Washington Post article about 3 weeks ago that said that the Koch brothers, these two brothers, Charles and David, spent more than every single American union combined in the 2012 election. So that's not, that's every working class, every working person's union, everything, everything from UAW to AFL-CIO, teachers unions, you name it, you add them all up, Teamsters, you put it in a pie, and these two oil brothers spent more. And that just tells you, well, that's probably a good segue to what Garland's issue is, the worldwide inequality of income.
Yeah, you know, there was a recent article that showed that 85 wealthiest people in the world have more money than one half of the people in the world, basically 3.5 billion. So 85 people have more money than as much or more money than 3.5 billion. So what that shows us is, you know, we look at the United States, and of course, it's, well, something that we were talking about earlier. We, you know, complain about the corporations running our governments. You know, we got to ask ourselves. We watched the inevitability of communism in the form that it was the Soviet Union fall apart. You know, there have been predictions that capitalism was headed in the same direction, and we've got to ask ourselves. You know, people never want to admit that something as major as the economic model that we use worldwide could be flawed and it could eventually fall. But we're moving towards a feudal system. Tell me, what's the difference between jolly old England with the feudal system there and the feudal system that we have today? If, you know, if we have the same thing, it just looks a little bit different. And the people at the very bottom, well, pretty much in the bottom of America, they have maybe more than the peasants, but it's still comparatively the same thing.
Well, the other thing is that we're just losing our middle class. I mean, I if you look at the wealth charts of the United States, this I found very interesting. So
I'm not on there, by the way.
Well, yes, you are. You're in the 50% that owns virtually nothing.
yes. Okay. Yes, that's me.
Yeah. Well, that's half of America. That's half of America.
Misery loves company, Terry.
1% of America has 1/3 of the nation's wealth. 10% of America has 2/3 of the nation's wealth. 20% of America has about 80%. And 50% of America has less than 1% of the nation's wealth. So half of America is basically living paycheck to paycheck with virtually nothing. Half.
And one of the things to realize that people don't really want to talk about or face, it's not just the 1% that is got us on this horrible path. It is as much the 20%, the top 20%, who are, you know, quite wealthy, quite comfortable players, shall we say.
Yeah.
And they are in there stirring the pot so that it benefits them, that they get all the soup and nobody else does, as much as the 1%. Unless we really crack that 20% group and get them to have some financial, moral, political responsibility, we're not going to make any progress.
So I had a...
Now, and you...
Go ahead, Gong.
Oh, and you add in that, you know, that 15, 18% or whatever, you know, the far right, the Tea Party, who don't have the money, but they support the very policies that keep them held down, that keep them oppressed, you know. So you've got that top 10%, whatever it is, but you've got another group of people who for a variety of reasons, you know, are really supporting the policies of those that are keeping them at the bottom. And we don't talk about those as much and how much of a part they play in producing this this income inequality.
Well, let's think about it.
If you look at, as an example, look at Congress, because of these Tea Party people, because of these right wingers, not just the Tea Party, but the Republican period, we can't get any decent legislation through that is going to control what's happening in Wall Street, and they're doing the same darn thing that they were doing before, but we can't stop it. And it's not because of the top 1 or 2 or 3% or 10%. It's because we've got a 15 or 18 or 20% who's saying, no, we're not in the top 1%, but we'll certainly stop it and do everything we can to benefit them.
Well, they don't simply realize, and somehow we have to help them realize, they are simply pawns. They truly are. They are not. Their ideology is frankly irrelevant in terms of that 1% or even the top 20%.
Well, except that they are manipulated. And I actually did a great show last Thursday with Sasha Abramsky of The Nation magazine, where he explained basically the origin and the continuation of a myth that is still very, very powerful, and in fact, you can see it all the time on Fox News, and that's the myth of the lazy poor, the myth that people who, and in this case, half the nation, or as Mitt Romney might say, 47% of the nation, basically doesn't want to work, and that if you're poor, it's due to some moral flaw on your point. So I want to take a break. When we come back, I want to explore this question of inequality. We'll also explore the myth of the lazy poor, and how we can confront it, how we can persuade people who are working hard in the working class, or maybe even the middle class, that, you know, that you are not morally at fault for being poor most of the time. Occasionally you are, but the vast majority of the time you are not. We'll be right back with more of the Raucous Caucus right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with
Terry D. Kester
and
Garland Nixon.
And we are the Raucous Caucus. We are here every Sunday at noon on We Act Radio, and you can also hear me, he, and us, all of us, live on my website, marklevinetalk.com. We also have archive shows there that you can check out, so you can hear us way back in the past arguing with each other. Gentlemen, whenever I debate a Republican, and I want to debate them, I think that they have some wild ideas, and they need debating. But whenever it seems that every single time I debate a Republican or a Libertarian on the issue of poverty or the American dream or income inequality, some form of this argument comes up. Basically, well, they should just get a better job. Well, you don't have to be at minimum wage. You can make more. You just have to work harder. Well, they need to be happy with the wages they have, or maybe if they haven't succeeded, they just haven't worked hard enough. Or even worse, maybe they're just sitting there waiting for their welfare check, and that is an incentive for them not to work, the unemployment aid or the welfare aid. And there's this idea, and it's not usually explicitly racist, though I do think that sometimes this relates back to good old Ronald Reagan, and I say that facetiously, and the idea of the welfare queen. But I do think sometimes there is this idea of a racial element to it, that all poor people are black and are taking welfare checks. And I don't know how to confront it except to show people the reality of working class America, to show them examples of the hardworking mother who's got three jobs and still has a single mother and has kids at home and is struggling to get by and can't afford enough to put food on the plate. The irony is, not only do they not want to give them unemployment insurance because they say, well, you know, people will take the money and not work, they don't want to raise the minimum wage so that people who do work can earn enough to actually take care of themselves. So I don't want to take it first, but I just think if we can't confront this myth and destroy this myth, that this myth does more damage, I would argue, than any other single thing in keeping people down.
Well, I'll start off by saying this, and that is that there is a book by George Lakoff called Moral Politics, and anyone who wants to understand that set of that framework, that way of thinking, should read that. I think all Democrats should read George Lakoff's Moral Politics, because it so clearly explains exactly that. The problem that we have often with right-wing policies are not the policies. It's the false premise that they believe that creates the policies. So what Lakoff says is, what they're saying is, we are being moral. The moral thing to do is help the poor. And if the poor are only poor because they're lazy, and if we give them more things and we help them out, it will only encourage them being lazy, because let's face it, the default position of all human beings is to be lazy and no account. So if you help them, it'll hurt them. As Rand Paul said, if we give unemployment benefits, that's going to create more unemployment. Why? Because people won't work. They'll just sit there and take it. So if you understand that, you understand why they were doing and why they're doing what they're doing. So yes, you're 100% on it. And I am happy to see that this false premise is finally being exposed to the public, because Lakoff wrote that book like 15 or 20 years ago.
I don't know about finally exposed, but there's two myths. There's that myth that the person who is unemployed or not making much money is somehow or other lazy. The other myth, which we are all subject to, and this is, it really gets down to human nature, and that's why you need a legal system that understands that human nature is flawed, at the very least. But the human nature is whatever we get, whatever we possess, whatever we earn, we feel at the very least that we deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a human reaction, and that goes all the way up the ladder. So if you're making $1 billion a day on Wall Street, by golly, you know that you deserve it. And anybody that's making less than you doesn't deserve it.
And if you're the child of the Earl of Sandwich, you therefore are born with a nice inheritance of $100 million and you get to live in the castle, then by God, at age four, the little Earl of Sandwich certainly thinks that he deserved every bit he gets.
Yeah, I mean, and it used to be, I mean, you have to understand where our whole concept of leadership even, you know, and in its beginning, the leaders were, in fact, sacred and viewed as sacred and still are in some societies today.
Pharaoh of Egypt was considered divine, and then so was the Sun King of France.
And then even when you move into an era like with our colonial era, the laws or traditions, if not laws, of primogeniture, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, existed. That the firstborn gets everything.
Right.
Because they deserve it.
Firstborn son.
Firstborn son.
It's never the girl. Just to be clear.
Right.
Go ahead.
And so even today, and you look at, you know, whether it's our athletes or our, you know, some of our leaders or our corporate leaders or Steve Jobs or whomever, everybody is preaching this thing, oh, well, they deserve it. You know, they deserve it because they're exceptional. They're great. Nobody, not even the raucous caucus, can succeed without a lot of people helping and working and serving and working with us.
That's
nobody
true.
Achieves.
But also, you know what? I don't mind saying that we have had certain great people. Some people are exceptional. Steve Jobs, you know, for all personally, he was apparently a very difficult person, but I think he was an exceptionally talented individual. But you know what? You can't have 100% exceptionally talented individuals, and it's no
shame.
Well,
you can't even with Steve Jobs. That's not even valid, because even with Steve Jobs, he's got hundreds of people working with him from the very beginning.
Well, that's
including
true.
The
Mark Wozniak,
CEO.
By the way, did a lot of the work.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
Mark Wozniak did a lot of the work. He didn't get any credit for it because he wasn't the salesman that Steve Jobs was, but he designed a lot of these things.
Yeah. I mean,
go ahead.
Nobody succeeds by themselves, period. You just can't do it.
That's true. That's true.
The other end of this that is equally as damaging to our society is that poor people are all poor because of their individual lack of discipline, their individual moral failure. Therefore, consequently, wealthy people are all wealthy because of their individual hard work. You know, it's funny, you'll hear when someone says, we need a, you know, fairer tax where the wealthy pay their fair share. And they'll say, why should we punish, quote, the best and the brightest? And I know we've all heard this, because in their worldview, being rich, it's kind of like Calvinism, you know, being rich by its very nature demonstrates that you are the best and the brightest, that you as an individual accomplished this, and we should continue. That's why we cut taxes on them, because we should reward these best and brightest and hardworking people.
Wait, let's remind people.
Really a twisted way of looking at the world. And when you look at the policies that they want to enact, it's clear that these policies are based on this screwed up premise. And what we get is, let me finish by saying this, what we get is the 9 of the 10 wealthiest states are blue states. 10 of the 10 poorest states are red states. 9 of the 10 healthiest states are blue states. 9 of the 10 unhealthy, if you can go on, 9 of the 10 best
educated
states are blue states. 9 of the 10 worst educated states are red states. Their policies, it's clear what they do, because they're based on false premises.
It's a race to the bottom. It's a race to the bottom. That's what they do. By the way, I remind people what Calvinism is for those who haven't studied John Calvin lately. Basically, the idea was that you are predestined to be one of the elect, one of the good, one of the righteous, one of the saved by God, or you're predestined to be a sinner or a horrible, terrible person. And the Calvinists didn't know who was predestined to be good or bad, but they could look and they could see and they'd say, oh, well, you're really wealthy. So you must be doing really well. And, you know, you must be one of the elect and you must be righteous and you're not. And therefore you're losing. And what's fascinating to me is that the whole premise of Christianity is the opposite. I mean, exactly. Jesus is the meek shall inherit the earth. Jesus was overturning the money changers in the temple. The both Old Testament and New Testament are all about looking out for the poor and the orphan and what you do to those that are least of me. That's what gets you in the kingdom of heaven. I mean, Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. And yet they have now taken this and Calvinistically turned the entire premise of the religion upside down, and they're still calling it Christianity.
Yeah, it's absurd, it's immoral, and it's insulting intellectually as well. It's also the problem that as a society, and this is partly due to technology and everything else, we are fragmented as a society, we are fragmented as a people. There is nothing that unifies us except maybe the Super Bowl, and even then we're at each other's throats for one team or the other. But, you know, somebody has said the only thing that unites Americans...
I just watched the commercials, Terry. I'm sorry, the commercials.
That's the other point. Somebody has said the only thing that unites Americans anymore is consumerism.
Yeah.
And that's it. And, you know, people don't even think in terms of the constructiveness of unions. People don't even think... People don't realize that it is human nature to a large degree, which is unfortunate, but most of us aren't going to go out and sacrifice ourselves a whole lot for others. You know, we're going to try to get ahead any way we think we can, and we try to do it morally if we're decent persons, and we rationalize no matter who we are. And you need a structure, be it religious, be it legal, however, you need a structure to say, wait a minute, we're all just flawed human beings. That takes a little bit of humility, which most people in America don't seem to have, at least at the very top. But to understand that we're all flawed, we all have weaknesses. United, we can achieve certain kinds of justice and equality. Divided, we can't achieve anything. But we don't believe that anymore. I mean, the Super Bowl next week will be won by about, you know, a couple thousand people that are involved with the team, the management, and everything else. And they will interview, of course, the quarterback. And that's it, basically. I mean, you know, he's the star, period. He's the one that made the game happen. No, that's not true. It's not true. But we don't accept that anymore.
Well, you're definitely right about the fact that I like to tell people, you know, none of us, not a single, you pick anyone on this planet, none of us could survive without other people. I mean, you are born a helpless baby into this universe. Everyone is. The strongest man, the smartest woman, you're all born a helpless baby. And we tend to die pretty helpless as well. And in the meantime, we need everyone there before us and after us to help care for us. And this idea that, well, you got yours, Jack, you know, you take all that help from your parents, from your relatives, from your society, from your schools, from your government, from your state, from your fellow human beings, that you take that and then you just keep it and you don't give back. It's profoundly selfish. And it's I think that part of what this myth is all about is a way to make people feel better about their own selfishness.
Well, the other part of it is this. I think, and, you know, maybe it's my cynicism, maybe it's my history, you know, in the African-American community, political history says that you understand, you know, number one, you know your political enemies, and number two, you recognize that there are some people that you cannot bargain with that must be defeated politically. So that being said, I still carry a lot of that with me today in politics. So what I think is, if someone has such a flawed premise and you listen to these people and you hear it is ingrained in their very DNA almost, that you're not going to strike a deal. That's why they won't strike a deal, because they believe so strongly in what they this flawed premise that anything else is immoral. And I think we have to defeat these people. I don't think you can really strike a deal with them. Well, you can't bargain with them because it's about morality to them, and we are being immoral by aiding and abetting the poor and just forcing them to be even more poor.
But you know what, Garland? I think sometimes you can use the illogic, just the sheer illogic of the argument against them. You know, when I think about, think about slaves in the United States of America living in the nation that proudly has their Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. And, of course, the person who wrote that, Thomas Jefferson, owned slaves. So he wrote that. So what slaves did when they did learn how to read was say, now wait a minute here. Your rhetoric is inconsistent with your actions. You know, look at they read the Bible. They were taught the Bible by Christian missionaries. And then what did they learn? They learned that Moses freed the slaves. And they're like, master, this story here, you know, shut up. So I think that take it up to Martin Luther King or Gandhi, that one of the ways to appeal to a democratic society is to say, hey, these are your ideals. You're not living up to your ideals. So I guess what I'm trying to say is this. Yes, there are always going to be hateful people. Yes, there are going to be always people who want to destroy poor people and put them down. But I do think that the more we could show that this rhetoric is simply false, the more we could show real people's lives to show that, yes, there are lots and lots and lots. In fact, the vast majority of working class people are working very, very hard, struggling to survive and are having a difficult time of it. The more we can tell their stories, the more we can get rid of this idea, this anecdote, that this false anecdote of the welfare queen.
And the only way that we could fight, you know, Garner brings up the point that we can't really argue with these people, and, you know, that we have to fight them. Well, you figure out, how do you fight? There's only one way you can fight, really, that's going to have any success, and that, again, is to unify. And I don't know how the heck we're going to do that in this fragmented society that we live in, but that's what has to happen. The middle class, the lower classes who are, you know, of different races and et cetera, that seem to be, you know, punished more than others, somehow that they've got to unify to understand that it is the nature of man to use slaves. It really, honestly is. It's throughout the history of the world. We've progressed beyond it to a large degree, but there's always energy to go back to exploit every single person, particularly the laborer, to not reward them, to not give them anything that's secure, because they are disposable people. And we've got to somehow create unity between all the groups that are down here in this 50% or lower, and understand that we are fighting the same battle.
So how do we get to a world where Garland started by talking about that 85 people have more wealth than 3.5 billion? So what 3.5 billion people, you would think, have a lot more power than 85. Right? 3.5 billion people all come into your place at once. I don't think the 85 can defend themselves. I don't care what they have, nukes or guns, whatever. They simply can't. What prevents, Garland, do you think, a global uprising?
Well, number one, there are a lot of people, and we see this in America. You know, you keep people just poor enough that they're not completely and totally desperate. And so they're scrambling around looking for food, trying to survive, and they don't really have the time nor the energy to try to figure out what's causing this problem or to fight back. So one of them is you keep people in desperation, and they're so busy trying to survive, and we see that in the United States, that you don't fight back. Number two, and I think this is the error that they're making. They have traditionally said, we're only going to push them, but so far, and then they'll still be able to survive, but we'll have mostly everything. I think we're passing that tipping point where it's getting to the point where they're pushing people over the edge. I think the super wealthy and the multinational corporations are going to force the hand of people by putting people in such desperation. You know, you can only push a person so far, and when they have no place else to retreat, and, you know, they're not going to eat each other. And I think we're moving in that direction. I don't know if it's 5 years, 10 years out. I don't know what it is, or maybe I'm even wrong. But that's what I think. I think they're pushing people into desperation. And the natural, just like Terry said, you know, the natural way is to exploit humans. I think the natural occurrence when people get pushed, but so far, is to fight back, be it with violence, be it with unity, whatever it is.
And one of the things that, you know, we can do and should do, and this includes you and me and Garland and Mark and all of us, there are things that are happening in the world that are amazing, that are absolutely truly amazing by human will and human giving and human sacrifice and human organization. And I'm not sure if you guys have heard this, or maybe I've mentioned it before, but India has finally eliminated polio.
Wow.
Yeah. They haven't had a case of polio in 3 years. This is done through the government of India putting up, it was like $28 million, hiring hundreds of people, literally going around to vaccinate everybody, also by the World Health Organization. The government of India, the World Health Organization, all working in unity with hundreds of people in India going around giving vaccinations, they have finally eliminated polio. That is an example of what socially conscious action can take. That is an example of what unification can, can accomplish, what unification can accomplish. It can be done. And it can be done in ways that actually have a long-range effect. I mean, just eliminating polio in India is going to empower people, period.
Well, it's such a brutal disease, and,
yeah.
You know, of course, India is a very difficult place to I mean, given all the poverty in India and the population, more than a billion people, that's no easy task.
No.
So
it's phenomenal. It can be done. And even economically, you know, poverty is on the decrease worldwide. Abject poverty is on the decrease. There are unified efforts.
And another important thing that I do want to mention before the show is over, and that is in Utah, the reddest state in America, they did a study and they found that it cost them through jail and emergency rooms, et cetera, about $16,000 a year per homeless person. And they said, well, you know what? It'll only cost us $11,000 to give them apartments. So they started doing that. They've eliminated poverty since they started the program, which was either 2 or 3 years, by 78%. And they project that by 2015, they'll have completely eliminated poverty. I mean, excuse me, I'd say homelessness. And it's something that is that's interesting. They simply did the numbers and said it's cheaper to give them an apartment. And I think that's something that we can hope to, we can hope to replicate.
For better or for worse,
part of that reason for Utah is that they are basically unified people in terms of the Mormon Church, which is still like 70% of the people in Utah belong to the Mormon Church.
But I've never understood why conservatives are so quick to incarcerate people, to incarcerate even drug users, and recognizing that incarceration is not just food and shelter and health care and education, it's security. I mean, it's not easy to keep people in prison and so forth, where if we just provided food and shelter and health care and education, that would be a heck of a lot cheaper. And, you know, I'll just give you an example. Just the other night, in fact, a friend of mine was out in D.C., gave me a call. He said there were two – it's a very, very cold night in the District of Columbia, and he saw two homeless men, and they were huddled together. It was like 15 degrees, and he said, Mark, do you know where we can find an emergency shelter? So I ran to the Internet, found one that was open in D.C., frankly, thankfully does have these things. And I'll give out the number. I'll find it, because I put it in my phone in case I this happens again. And they came, with a warm van, and the two men were a little suspicious, but eventually went in. And my friend saved their lives. He saved two people's lives, and it's just amazing what you can do with just a little bit of compassion. It took about half an hour, and those two men could easily have died. It was 12 degrees. I mean,
and
easily could
have
died.
We do have an extraordinary opportunity here, because we do have President Obama, who I think does care about these issues, and we also have Pope Francis, who does care about these issues. And there is a case where the unification between just those two world leaders could be truly significant.
Let me give out this number, just because I want everyone to know it. And you could put it in your phones. In fact, if you live in the D.C. area, you should put it in your phones. 1-800-535-7252. It's the Emergency Homeless Shelter Hotline. 1-800-535-7252. If you see somebody that's homeless, particularly on a cold night, and you think they need some help, and listen, sometimes they could be mentally ill. Sometimes they could be subject to substance abuse. You can save a life yourself. You can literally save a human life by calling 1-800-535-7252. Don't forget what you as an individual can do. My friend inspired me, and I have this number in my phone, and every time I see a homeless person that is in need of help, I'm going to call this number.
Well, something else, it's another thing that's positive, the Obama administration, they're relaxing some of the stringent rules and regulations they have regarding marijuana, so that now banks are going to be allowed to lend money to companies that these, you know, to do business basically with the companies in the states where marijuana is legal. They are relaxing some of the sentencing guidelines and things of that nature. So there is, you know, there are some positive things going on, I think. And I think, you know, we look at people say there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Well, there are not enough differences, but you'd never get that with the Republican administration. And so what I say is there are not enough differences, certainly for the three of us, but at least there are some. And, you know, you got to take what you can get.
Yeah, witness Virginia and the Attorney General.
That's right. That's right. That's the difference an election makes. And that's why when people say, you know, I don't vote, they're all the same, I say, you know what? You're the problem. You're the problem as much as the Republicans are the problem.
Yes.
If you don't participate in your democracy, well, what can I say? You don't deserve to have one. I mean, the democracy is all about us giving our voice. And if you stay home on election day, well, you know, then you kind of get the government you deserve.
Yep.
And failing to vote is a way of voting. Not participating is participating in a way.
Right. It's kind of like standing by when someone's harming somebody else.
Yeah, and when people talk about the threat to our society and our country, it's not from invasion. It's from our own apathy.
Isn't that what Martin Luther King continually said? You know, it's the people that sit on the side and don't do nothing. The people that sit on their hands, those are the ones that allow bad things to happen.
That is what he said. Was it Pogo that said the enemy is not in our stars, it is ourselves?
It is us.
So there we go. Watch out. The enemy is within us.
Yep. But at least we've identified the enemy today.
Well, yeah, so that's good. So we've worked it all out. And as usual, we have solved all of the world's problems in an hour, which is an amazing thing that we bring to you every week, Sunday, noon, the Raucous Caucus, right here on WEACT Radio, AM 1480, and all the other places that you can hear us, marklivingtalk.com. Terry, if they want to find you, you're in Oregon somewhere in industrial wasteland. Where do they look for you?
Doctor of Democracy. Only parts of it are wasteland. Only
okay.
parts. The rest of it's beautiful.
DR of Democracy at
AOL.com.
AOL.com. And Garland?
Garland N is my email address, garlandn at gmail.com or at Garland Nixon on Twitter, or I'm on Facebook.
And you can find me at Mark Levine Talk on Twitter, and my website's marklevinetalk.com. Coming up next is the Inside Scoop. We're going to talk more, actually, in a lot of detail about poverty and what can be done about it. And I'm going to be debating one of those wild conservatives who's going to blame the poor again. And I'll show you at least how I deal with that kind of rhetoric. So thank you, Garland. Thank you, Terry.
Mark.
Tune in next week for another edition of the Raucous Caucus. Thank you.